these conservative pundits like George Will, Charles Krauthammer, have variously come out against Pope Francis at different times for positions that he takes that they consider too liberal. And what we saw on July 10th, so last Friday on Rush Limbaugh's show, is Limbaugh went into this five-minute tirade attacking the Pope and calling him a clown, essentially, for criticizing what the Pope called unfettered capitalism. On July 9th, Pope Francis was addressing a crowd in Bolivia, and he said that unbridled capitalism is the, quote, dung of the devil, something that that fosters and encourages and allows inequality to thrive. And, of course, inequality and suffering, these are things that the Pope, as the pontiff of the Catholic Church, he wants to, you know, make the world a better place for his billion followers and for the billions more who live on this planet and share it with him. He's always been a crusader against inequality. It's always been something he cares about. And the fact that he cares about it just enrages the right wing. But people like even Rush Limbaugh used to speak out against unfettered and unbridled capitalism back when it was in vogue with the conservative right wing. But now that it's something that is considered more liberal, and now that the sides have sort of figured out where they land on these things, the Pope gets criticized. But, you know, nobody's looking to Rush Limbaugh for religious conviction or for some sort of concept of morality. The Pope is a figure who matters in the lives of hundreds of millions of people worldwide, and I guess they just can't stand that when he speaks out against about things, they can't stand when he comes down on the side where President Obama or Bill and Hillary Clinton or Democrats happen to be. Anytime he says something that agrees with the politics of the Democratic Party, they come out and attack him. But when he says things that they agree with, they, of course, like, laud that and say, oh, hey, look at the Pope. The Pope says that the Pope is still against abortion, so, you know, that means that their stance on abortion is still valid. But when the Pope says that climate change is an issue or inequality is an issue, they say, wow, he's just a leftist.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KABU is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
The time is 6:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7. This is Labor Radio, hosted tonight by Elizabeth Ann McDonald and Fernando Gapacin. Tonight, our show is going to be about, going to be an interview that I did yesterday, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Today, we have Miriam Frank. She's the author of Out in the Union. She's an adjunct professor of humanities at New York University. She is a member of the United Auto Workers, both as an academic at NYU and as a member of the National Writers Union. Welcome to our show tonight, Miriam.
Hi there, Fernando, and hello, listeners.
I got a chance to read. I just started reading out in the Union, and it does a really excellent job in sort of highlighting the role of LGBT folks in the Union movement. Would you mind telling us what motivated you to write the book?
Well, a lot motivated me to write the book. My own life as a lesbian, who myself, I came out in the Union over a period of time, out in the various unions that I worked for or was a member of, and it wasn't easy. And I also was looking at the many things that lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender people were achieving through collective bargaining and through union representation. And I was noticing that from about the early 1980s on. And I wanted to know if anything had gone on before that, because I have a labor history way of looking at things. And I didn't know what had gone on before that. I knew of a couple of famous labor leaders who were gay and were closeted or not closeted. And I wanted to get beyond leadership and into what was going on in the lives of ordinary working people, union members, and ordinary gay people. So I wanted to know if anything had gone on before that. I did some checking around in archives. I read union histories. I found nothing or very little. I would go to the index of various modern labor history books and look at gay and look that up in the index. Nothing. So I decided to talk to the people who were making the history and living the life. And the way to do that is to interview people. And I knew people who had done things that were very interesting already in the early 1980s. So I began interviewing people. I interviewed older people a lot, people who at that time were in their 70s, retired. I'm very glad I did, because I knew that history would go away in the course of time sooner than my own. And that began to start me thinking about the reforms that we were winning and how we won them as sexual minorities within the labor movement. I wanted to collect living history, and I used my own work as a labor educator to outline the issues. Once I had collected about 50 interviews, I really saw that there were themes and topics that were important and issues that kept on coming up and campaigns that were absolutely gay, queer, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, issues that were coming up in the workplace that really needed a way to look at them and a way to be solved that involved LGBT politics. And in the early 1980s, those politics were not as defined and not as organized in queer communities. Queer communities were trying to figure out what their place was in American political life. So we didn't have the kind of thing that we have today with large coalitions and national organizations and people on, you know, people being interviewed on TV, and it wasn't proper conversation for the union hall either. And so I wanted to bring that out, literally. What was it like to be in the life? And was it like to be in the life and be a union leader? What was it like to be queer and working on an assembly line, and people were making hostile jokes and they didn't know that the person next to them was gay? All that kind of thing. So I wanted to see what that connection did to create a political world for gay people. So that's briefly why I decided to do this, how I decided to do this. And I'm going to, if I may,
yes,
I'm going to read a story from one activist. Is that okay?
Yeah, fine. Yep. Please.
Okay. So this is from the chapter that I wrote that I titled Outsiders as Insiders, Sexual Diversity and Union Leadership. And I went to interviews that I did with people who were workers, but also rank-and-file leaders. I spoke with a lady named Marcy Johnson. She was a registered nurse in Seattle at a school for developmentally disabled adults. And she was a terrific nurse, and everybody at her job knew that she was gay, and it was just part of, you know, hi, how was your weekend? But she was also the union's delegate. She was a member of the delegate assembly of the Service Employees Union up there in Seattle. And she stood there to address the delegate assembly about why the union should be backing a campaign that had to do with gay rights. And that was rough because she hadn't really told the world that she was a lesbian. You know, you tell your workmates if it's a liberal enough workplace. But this was in 1993. And she wanted the union to fight a petition drive that would put two anti-gay proposals on the November 1994 ballot. And the union had been approached by a group called Hands Off Washington that was trying to build a coalition to keep this anti-gay initiative off the ballot. And one of those initiatives would have prohibited making sexual orientation a protected class. It would have barred public school teachers from talking about homosexuality. And Initiative 610 would have forbidden recognition of domestic partnerships. It would have restricted public libraries from giving kids access to books about homosexuality. And it would have banned gay men and lesbians from adopting children or providing foster care. And from getting custodial rights in divorces. So this was basically the radical right agenda to stop gay people from having public lives. And SEIU already had, Marcy's union, already had a constitutional amendment stating that sexual orientation would be a protected class. They had adopted that in 1984. But the executive board of Local 1199 Northwest wanted to figure out if they should support and provide resources to the Hands Off Washington request. And the board decided that they would have a part of their delegate assembly, a panel of various minorities would talk about to the delegates to explain why their concerns were union concerns. And Marcy said, well, I'll talk about gay rights because I'm gay. And that was the first time she really said, I'm going to talk about it to people that don't know me just from the workplace. So she told the assembly that she would be a likely victim of the discrimination, and if Ordinance 608 or Measure 608 or Measure 610 would ever become law. And then there was a discussion, and the delegates said that the union should oppose the initiative. One nurse said that she didn't agree with people's lifestyles, but it wasn't her decision because God made everybody, and that, you know, that was fine for Marcy. But then when Marcy went to the ladies' room after the assembly, there was like this very, very cold feeling among the people who were in there, and they weren't talking to her. And although the assembly adopted and did say we're going to help this initiative, we're going to help destroy this initiative, and they did. It never got to the ballot. They really organized very well. She could feel the chill in the room. And she understood that even though people were willing to vote the right thing, she had to play a stronger role in changing the culture for all nurses and for all healthcare workers about whether or not it was okay to be out at work and out in the union. So that's part of the book. That's one story. And I wanted to give you a story from the Northwest.
Well, you know, Your book, like mine, addresses the issue of building solidarity among working people in the labor movement. We both speak to the issue of the need to bind the economic interests of unions, for instance, collective bargaining, and the affirmation of civil rights for LGBT people in your book's case, and racial minorities in mine. And that there's, you know, these are rights that are assumed by the predominant heterosexual white male majority. Were there specific instances? Because I know the LGBT people, folks, built their influence within the labor movement in a similar way. They built caucuses. They grew their influence within the union movement, and it took real organizing.
It sure did. And you know, that wasn't an idea that a couple of gay people just dreamt up. They had looked at what Latino caucuses had done. They had looked at what the Black Civil Rights caucuses had done. They understood what the Coalition of Labor Union was building in the service sector. And they also understood that even though the leadership of most unions was white and male, they also understood that if you take all the different sexual minorities and racial minorities and put them all together, and women, that is a majority, maybe not in leadership, but certainly in the growing part of the labor movement's membership. So there was some confidence that this could win as long as we had the guts to stand up in front of our coworkers and say, this is about me. This is about my life as a gay person in America. And that was the organizing handbook of Black trade unionists, of Latino trade unionists, of Asian trade unionists. That's how that works. And it did get some good organizing done. And there were many cases when gay people stood up and said that, they got help from the racial minority groups. So solidarity is an issue that gets built from the ground up, and that's what we believe.
You know, we have to take a quick station break.
Okay.
I just want to let folks know you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland 90.7. This is Labor Radio of, by, and for the working class. Back to Miriam Frank.
Hi.
Miriam, currently the union movement is faced with unprecedented social, economic, and political attacks. The Supreme Court is poised to hear the Fredericks versus the California Teachers Association case, which threatens to wipe out agency shop.
In the public sector.
Yes. The union movement is fighting for its life. How can out in the union be used to help strengthen the union movement?
Well, it's a labor history of queer America. And labor history is always one of our tools. It shows us where we have been, what we have fought against, what we have fought for, and how things worked in the past. And we then decide how that tool can be applied to questions of the future. And clearly, with the attacks on public sector organizing, and they're coming from various different directions, we have to not think of our very, very large public sector unions as big, large unions that you can't touch. Those unions have to continue to reach out into communities and work with community coalitions on their issues. And the good side of that is that the teachers' unions, the social service unions, all the public sector unions have always worked, really, in their history, with community organizations, and they are just going to have to work that much harder, and communities are going to have to rediscover their union roots. I am relentlessly optimistic, and I sometimes wonder why, but that's my attitude. I don't know what will happen. I'm sure there will be some heavy blows. I don't think it will be the end of organizing, and I sure don't think it will be the end of labor gay coalitions.
As I read your book and was learning about the specific history and struggles of LGBT folks in the union movement, many of these were stories that I hadn't heard. Some were stories that I was very familiar with, but I hadn't heard the angle from gay people. Can you explain a little bit about why did you use oral history methodology to write this book? I was fascinated by it.
Well, that's exactly why I used oral histories in the end, because I wanted people to be fascinated by the stories and not to just see them as statistics and newspaper reports. So I also needed to use oral history because although I knew the stories were out there, I didn't know how to find them. And so I would interview people that I had heard had done something phenomenal. For instance, I knew that Marcy Johnson was a leader within the Nurses Union in Seattle in the early 1990s, and she's still active. And I needed the information, and I knew I could check what people told me once I knew that there was a story. So, for instance, with this fighting about hands-off Washington, after I talked with Marcy about her experience, I started looking at newspaper reports in the newspaper archive, and I found a film that the Hands Off Washington people had made. That film was interesting because it was all about the Hands Off Washington campaign, and it was a good movie, but it didn't say anything about the union. So I said, well, I've got to highlight this. I've got to highlight how 1199 helped out and made it a definitely a working class issue. And that really motivated me to put Marcy's story at the top of a chapter on leadership. I also knew that the oral history stories would tell people about the humanity and the ordinary textures of these extraordinary struggles. And I wanted people to as readers to listen and hear their own voices and hear their own conversations as they organize, as they think about a new contract, as they live their lives, whether they are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, or whether there's someone that they like very much or there's a relative that they know. I wanted them to feel that these stories, which were very ordinary people, but they were doing extraordinary things, and how they could relate to that. And oral history is great for that because you can put yourself into those stories without it being too complicated, but at the same time, it can be very profound.
You know, it's interesting how these oral histories intersected. There were a couple folks that you talked about that I also had interviewed in a different context.
Is that right?
Yeah. Like, for instance, Cal Noyce out of Utah. When I was doing the research for Union Cities and I was talking to different Central Labor Council presidents, Cal was one of the presidents that I interviewed.
Yes.
And literally, we spent 4 hours on the telephone because his discussion was so rich, and it was focused on the building of the labor movement. And it was him being gay came into the discussion in terms of how they had built a labor gay rights movement, and he was describing how that happened in Salt Lake City, and I was just enthralled by it and amazed at how integrated his discussion was about growing the labor movement.
Well, it was about his own life, too, because coming out, first of all, in his community and in his family, he was he came from a family that had very strict views about the straight way of sexuality, and there was no way he could conform to that, and he eventually broke away from the religious world, but he maintained a very loving relationship with his parents and siblings. And he also has so much respect in the trade. He still does have so much respect in the labor movement in Utah. Not that that's an overwhelming part of the workforce in Utah. Utah is not only a very strict religious culture, but there's also right to work in Utah. And I think that the trade unionists he worked with all understood that if we don't work together, we're not going to work at all. So people had to let go of their prejudices if they wanted to be involved with a terrific organizer like the guy he is. So, and we've known Cal for quite a long time. He came into the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender labor scene just by sort of writing a big hi. This is what we're doing in Utah. What are you guys doing? And he didn't even know what we were doing in on the East Coast and the West Coast. He just came up and did it. And he was delighted to find out that he was not alone, not a bit, you know. So he's phenomenal. But, you know, when you look at the fact that Utah, for all its conservatism and for all its right to workism, was one of the first states that started having marriage after the DOMA decision came down, the Supreme Court decision that eliminated the Defense of Marriage Act. One of the first states where people started marrying was Utah. And the newspapers in New York, where I live, were going, oh, that's so strange. Look at that, Utah. And I didn't think it was strange at all. I said, there's a political coalition working there in Salt Lake City that was very together, very clearly understood its opposition. And I am convinced that that coalition, part of its strength was that it also was connecting with an embattled labor movement that understood what a battle is.
Well, I know that here in Oregon, we battled ballot measure 9, and which turned back anti-gay legislation. And unions played a very big role in terms of that fight. And in later years, more conservative parts of the labor movement united to fight for equal rights for LGBT folks. This book just came out last year and out in the union, and I'd recommend it to everybody. And this is a book that, for people who are like Northwest centric, it contains a lot of discussion about what we've done in the Northwest as well. And you're going to be coming out to Portland in the near future, aren't you? And possibly yes. Doing some book shows.
We're planning a couple of book events in Portland, Oregon. We haven't gotten the venues and the dates set yet, so I cannot announce them. The name of the book is Out in the Union: A Labor History of Queer America, and you can, if you are in the Northwest, if you are in Portland, you can purchase it at your local bookseller. They will special order it if they run out of it. I'm sure there's going to be a real run on this book after this broadcast. But, you know, it is available, Temple University Press. And Fernando will be announcing when we have the book event in early August. So I look forward to meeting people who are interested in the topic when we arrive in Portland.
Well, I'm sorry that our time's up, but we'll be talking to you more and seeing you here in Portland, Miriam.
Okay, well, solidarity to you, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. This is Labor Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7. Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Religion for Life. My guest this week is Nicole Garcia. She is a transgender Latina of faith, the first transgender person of color to seek ordination in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. It is time, beloveds, to make the church queer on Religion for Life. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Some people look, some people stare, some people turn away, stumbling over words.
The time is 6:30 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see.
Good evening. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Prison Pipeline, and I'm your host, Emma Lugo. Today, I'm very honored to have a guest with me. His name is Dave Trular, and he is an author. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Emma. It's great to be here.